Welcome, 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 welcome back. This is BTSC's podcast, Meeting You Where You Are. I am Chris Simon.
And I'm Jada McCray.
Jada, I feel good today. How about you?
I feel fantastic today.
I see you got your braids in. You got the Fenty Beauty on.
A little bit, glowing a little bit.
Like a little special occasion. Well, I got my tie on. I got my Magna Pell on.
You've caught me slipping so many times, and I knew who our guest was, so I just wanted to bring a little extra.
Because we usually come after yoga.
Yes.
So we usually sweat it out. Mm-hmm. And Jada, the funny part about this is that y'all don't know that, but Jada comes to yoga with a full face of makeup because she knows we record the podcast after this, so she wants to make sure that she's right.
The only person I want to see that face is my husband. That's because we got a commitment.
Till death do us.
Literally in the morning, it looks like death.
And be like, huh? Well, since you have me, does that mean we're good to go now? But no, Jada, you know how you feel like you started in your career. I'm just talking about my radio career right now.
Your radio career.
Yeah, my radio career. Mm-hmm. You hear my radio voice?
Yes.
But oh, no, like literally.
6 months of it. Go ahead.
I feel like my radio career, I feel like, you know how you actually feel like you made it?
Yes.
Today I feel like I made it.
Special guest in your head all the time.
Yeah, because we got a special guest here. I feel like our podcast now is about to be super official.
I think we're kind of legit. I think this legitimizes our podcast.
Does it?
Yeah, this is
so
serious.
So me being on a podcast doesn't legitimize it?
No, actually, it kind of, never mind.
Kind of hurts it?
A little bit.
Send the camera, Lord. But today, Jada, we have a special guest that I'm excited about. We have State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. How you
Hi,
doing?
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Pretty good. Did
Jada?
I say it right?
Yes, you did. State's
because
Attorney.
Your people always said States. Because Sarita did a flyer for something, and they sent back and said State's Attorney. I think we put State in there versus not the apostrophe S.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's State's Attorney.
Yeah. If I would have asked Jada, you would have knew that, huh?
Of course.
So, well, it's funny, though, because when you go all across the different, like, to the country, they're referred to, prosecutors are referred to different things. Mm. So they're district attorneys in, like, New York or Massachusetts, and it's actually in Florida, in Orlando, it is state attorney.
Really?
There is no apostrophe.
So I wasn't wrong. Look at Serena over there excited. Like, look, I was right. I was right.
You were wrong because in Maryland, it's the apostrophe S.
Okay.
And there are 24 state's attorneys, and I'm the state's attorney for Baltimore City.
Gotcha. So do you watch the show Billions?
Nope.
Okay, because the guy is there. He's the district attorney or something. I always be watching. I'm like, is this a comparable to what Maryland is?
Yeah, the district attorney in other places is comparable to me as state's attorney. It's your local prosecutor, elected position.
All right, so we're just going to go ahead and hop right in because we have some great stuff. We know that you are up for re-election. What we wanted to do is that our Meeting You Where You Are podcast, we like to focus on mental health, behavioral health, stuff that's happening in the community. Mm-hmm. And just shedding light on great things that are happening to the community, some of the disparities, so that we can learn and we can develop programming and grow from there. So I feel like you are a phenomenal guest to reference
you.
On this.
I appreciate it.
So before we get too far, I know that you've been in the media.
Yeah,
you've been on local news, national news.
International news.
And some of the stuff, they can promote a persona or personality that is true. Or not true, you know? I see you in church, I see you in the community, but not just living in the community. I mean, not just visiting the community, you actually live in the community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So versus what I want to do is dispel any thoughts that or ideas that people may have of things they've seen on TV and who you are. So how about you let our listeners know who exactly you are?
So, I mean, I guess I'm not a devil with the horns growing out of my head and a tail between my legs. Is that what you were insinuating?
No.
I'm only kidding. So who I am, I'm a wife. I'm a mother. I'm the youngest chief prosecutor of any major American city. But I am very much vested in the city of Baltimore. I tell people all the time, I don't have to turn on the news and open up the newspaper to see the violence plaguing our community. All I have to do is open up my door. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm raising my two little girls, 7 and 9. Mm-hmm. You know, they attend Baltimore City Public Schools. And, you know, I'm a public
servant. So you have a
7 and 9 year old?
Yes. My son turns 8. So currently I have a 7 and a 9 year old. But Sunday, I'll have an 8 and 9 year old.
Oh.
Carson's birthday is Saturday.
You make me tired just saying that. I have a 4 and a 9 year old. And
4 and 9.
Yeah. I'm sorry, 5. I just totally disrespected Daisy.
And Daisy was on the news yesterday.
She was on the news yesterday.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying, I'm a public servant. So every day I get up, I feel blessed to be, you know, serving the citizens of Baltimore City.
So a lot of people know you because of things that's happened in Baltimore, but a lot of people don't know that you're not actually from Baltimore. Is that correct?
Nope. I was born and raised in Boston, Massachusetts. So right in Dorchester.
Does that make you a Patriots and a Red Sox fan?
No, it does not.
Okay. I just want to say, in the podcast, we're done.
I'm fully vested in Baltimore, okay?
Yeah, let me clarify. I'm an Orioles and Ravens fan. Okay. Okay.
So, no. I still get these little nasty text messages from my family members every now and then, call me a traitor, but.
Gotcha. But you did think about the Patriots when they won the Super Bowl. Did you think about putting the Patriots jersey on?
Well, no. Honestly, I didn't put it on because I feel like, you know, I'm always for the underdog.
Gotcha.
And I think that they've done some real grimy things.
I mean,
so, you know, I'm not.
Would you have prosecuted
the
them?
Gate.
I'm just kidding. So you're from Boston, right?
Uh-huh.
But you were, where were you? Give them some of your background as far as educational background.
So actually, I was part of one of the longest standing desegregation programs in the country. I was in a busing program. Mm. So from second grade when I was 6 years old, until I graduated high school, I had to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I was bused an hour out of the inner city of Boston to one of the richest towns in Massachusetts, where when I first started school at 6 years old, I was the only black child in the entire school.
Oh, my.
Really?
So, yeah, you learn very early on, though, you know, you get these negative sort of depictions of what black people are, but I took on the responsibility of being a positive representation for black people, right? And what I had to learn very early on is that, you know, these negative sort of stereotypes that little kids would come up to me, you go, girl, right? And
yeah.
I'm like, I don't talk like that. Why are you talking to me like that? You're talking like that because I'm black?
Mm-hmm.
But you just learn how to just say, you know, it's not malicious.
Mm-hmm.
It's more due to a lack of exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can say that very early on, I took on that responsibility. I was part of, you know, SGA, a co-editor of the school newspaper, honors classes. You know, you can either decide to be angry about it or you can decide to go in a positive sort of direction. And I did that. So when I graduated, you know, I was only three. There was only three black girls that graduated in my class.
Oh, they got up to three by then.
Yes, by three by then. And,
from six
years old until I was 18.
Wow.
That's then, one every 3 years. Well, two every 9 years, right?
Well, that was just my class. So
yeah.
There was a group they referred to us as the Metco kids.
The Metco?
Metco kids.
What is that?
It stands for Metropolitan Educational Opportunity.
Okay.
So transit opportunity. So again, it's the busing program. And we were referred to as the Metco kids, and we would be bused out there. So there were other black students, but they were in other grades.
Gotcha. I'm sure you greatly benefited from that educational experience, too.
Absolutely. I think it was an awesome experience. Again, you know, education, you're exposed at a very early age to socioeconomic disparities in the educational system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having to get up and see the difference between Dorchester, which is a predominantly black neighborhood, to Dover Sherborne, which, again, is the richest town in Massachusetts. You know, these kids were getting Porsches, you know, when they turned 16.
Oh, wow.
And then
I got a Geo Metro when I was 21.
Right.
I got a Geo Metro hatchback when I was 21.
I got a Dodge Omni and had to work for it.
I had an Oldsmobile. My grandmother gave me her 1985 Oldsmobile. Hey, I'm pushing.
So I got mine from my grandmother's next door neighbor, Miss Larbell. That's her name, Miss Larbell. She stopped driving. She had like some cataract issues or something like that.
Goodbye.
So she had this car sitting. It was a Geo Metro and it was a hatchback. And that was my first car.
She had cataract issues. I wonder if she actually gave it to you or if it just disappeared from her driveway one day.
No, Jada. Hey, Jada, we're sitting next to a state's attorney. Are you going to try to accuse me of stealing this lady's car? How dare you?
That's a lot of pressure for someone so young, such a little girl. And to have to go to literally be a representative for all black people from what they were exposed to.
Well, I mean, I just, again, it was something that I accepted and I appreciated and I had to kind of understand at a very early age. I can still remember my yearbook quote, you know how you put the little sayings.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Nikki Giovanni quote and it said, I would not reject my strength, though it's not by choice, but responsibility.
Mm.
I think that that's still applicable to who I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you talk about me now being in this role, which is a male dominated position, where 95% of the prosecutors in this country are white, 79% are white men, and as a woman of color, I represent 1%. you just understand and you recognize that it's greater than you individually, and that's something that has been instilled in me since mm-hmm. since I was a little girl.
The therapist in me just wants to say that that must have been really...
You're trying to put her on the sofa already?
No, she's not on the sofa, but I'm just saying, thinking about a child who had to bear that much responsibility, it teaches you about who you are really early on, and it just shows you how tough you are inside, and I mean, that's amazing to me.
Are you about to cry?
No, I'm not going to cry.
Oh, I'm going to say, Jay's like, recovering. I'm not about to mess up this eyeshadow. So what is college and stuff like that? Where did you go?
So after I graduated from Dover Sherborne, I received a presidential scholarship to Tuskegee. I only applied to 3 schools, having gone through that experience. I only applied to Tuskegee, Spelman, and Hampton.
Well, you knew what you were working with.
I knew what I was working with.
Oh,
Janine's
going to be upset now she found out you could have went to Hampton and you
well,
didn't.
Well, let me tell you.
Janine and Sanjay.
I didn't.
Okay.
I really wanted to get a foundation, like having been the only black person mm-hmm. in a school. I wanted to go to a historically black school, mm-hmm. and I really wanted to get my foundation. So I got a presidential scholarship to Tuskegee. And nice. So that's the reason why I ultimately went to Tuskegee. And I was a poli-sci major. I met my husband at Tuskegee University.
Oh, shout out to Nick Mosby.
Nick Mosby. And we were college sweethearts, so we've been together for 20 years now.
All right.
Yeah, I know. I'm dating myself.
20 years, wow.
People can figure out my age, but, you know, it was a great experience and one of the best decisions I could have made.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
So then you went to law school from there?
Yep. So, you know, I graduated Tuskegee University magna cum laude with a 3.8.
So I had to ask you about law school. Like, you were about to stop there. If I was magna cum laude, I would have led with that.
Oh, no. No, but magna cum laude at Tuskegee, that's when I graduated. And then, you know, one of the things that was really crazy when I graduated, I was, like, president of Pi Sigma Alpha, which is the Honor Society of Poli-Sci, you know, bioethics debate team, very much involved in extracurricular activities. But when I applied for law school, I didn't do as well on my law school entrance examination. And it's so funny because I was waitlisted to every single law school that I applied to.
Oh, really?
And it was, you know, in that moment, I guess those obstacles, you kind of have to think outside the box. Mm-hmm. And so I started to call around to all of the law schools and say, you know, I really think you need to meet me because my law school entrance examination is not indicative of my potential.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And all these people were like, oh, you can't do that. That's not how it's traditionally mm-hmm. done. And I'm like,
being resourceful.
I'm going to do
that. That's
what
I mean
yeah.
about
done.
Building, being self-assured really early on.
Well, we were, thankfully, I was fortunate enough. I was a part of a program called Council on Legal Educational Opportunity. It was sponsored by the American Bar Association. And I did a 6-week pre-law prep program. And I ended up getting into a couple of those law schools, but my top choice was Boston College Law School because it was a top 25 law school. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to be a public servant and I wanted to go home so I could take out less loans.
Mm-hmm. I get that in-state tuition.
Right.
I got you.
But in the end, I was thankfully able to get into my first choice
wow.
because I thought outside the box and mm-hmm. I asked them for an interview and mm-hmm. I kept calling and calling and
nice.
Saying, you know, what's the status? What's the status?
So you've been advocating for a while. Of what you want and what you see that is a good idea that people might not know. You've been a self-advocator for a while.
Well, I think you have to be. You know, when you're young, you're mm-hmm. black, and you're not presented with the same sort of opportunities, you have to be your own sort of advocate.
So you say your husband is in politics as well. You said Nick, your
yes.
love of 20 mm-hmm. years. Or maybe you've just been together 20 years, and maybe your love lasted longer than that. No, I didn't want Nick to be like, oh, so you only love me for 20 years? We've been, you know, whatever. I didn't want to start any beef because I know in my household how things go.
Oh, my God.
I have to be cautious and with my words.
I've seen them together. I think the love is still strong there.
No, I didn't say that it expired. I'm just saying if they've been married 20 years.
Yeah.
Then obviously, hopefully, you've been in love longer, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's all that I was saying.
So we've been in love.
Jada is trying to stir stuff up today.
No, I'm not stirring the pot. Listen.
Jesus.
We've been in love for 20 years. And I can
okay.
say I met him at 18 and he was 19. So I was a freshman, you know, and he was a sophomore at Tuskegee. And Nick was Mr. Freshman, Mr. Sophomore, Mr. Junior, Mr. Senior. So he was
really?
Mr. Popularity, right? And here you got this girl coming from north down south and getting with Mr. Popularity.
Yeah.
Little to say, I didn't have that many friends.
Aww.
But it was all good. But no, one of the things that drew me to my husband was that he wanted to be a public servant. He wanted to come back. Everything about who he is and what he was about was Baltimore. Mm. And he loves the city so much. And, you know, I was really drawn to the fact that he was not only attractive, but he had a brain. Mm. And, like, you could have an intellectual sort of conversation with him, and he wanted to do more than just be make money. Like, it was really about giving back and providing for his community.
Yeah, you can still see that. And now, what is Nick doing now? He's
So Nick, he was a city councilman. He then ran for mayor, and he didn't win, but he is now a state delegate. So he represents the 40th district for Baltimore City.
So he's down in Annapolis.
He's in Annapolis right now. Yeah, it's hard right now. 90 days that they're in session, it's rough when you got those little ones.
Yeah, having to handle all of that on top of your career. We're going to get into that part as well. But I think that what we should transition to is I want to talk about what we already know, but then I want to get to the parts that we don't know.
Sure.
So let's go ahead and get the part out that we know and then get back into the stuff that we actually don't know. Because I know you, so I know a little bit more. But I just think that I really want to make sure that our listeners in the world gets an opportunity to see all the great things that I get to experience and know. And
I like how he just said that he knows you. Like, if we saw each other in Target, we would just walk on by. No, everybody.
Why are you making this about
Chris knows
you.
Chris knows Marilyn, everybody.
You keep trying to stir up the pot. Jesus. What is going on here, Jada? All right. So, but we're going to approach this from a different perspective, right? We know Freddie Gray has been one of the, not most notable, but most high-profile cases or things that you've had to prosecute or you've been in a part of. But I want to approach it from a different perspective. I'm not sure if you've been asked this question on the news and everything before, but where were you when you first heard about this whole Freddie Gray situation?
So I think the first time that I heard about it was actually I was on social media, and it popped
Jada
up.
Jada's like, darn.
It popped up.
Jada, I'm not even going to tell you what Jada said. Jada says, why don't I ever say I was in the bathroom when I heard about it? Because that's where I am when I hear a lot of stuff. I said, Jada, I don't think anybody's going to say that on a podcast.
I can't believe you just talked
about it. Oh, you want to stir the pot? I'm going to stir the pot.
When people say, well, where were you when JFK got shot? People are like, oh, yes, I was speaking in front of Congress when we got there. I mean, nobody ever says, you know what, I was in the bathroom when I found out devastating news. Not to make light, but, you know, you just never hear that.
Yeah.
No, but I was actually in my bedroom, and I was on social media, and the video popped up. And I forwarded it to my deputies and said, what's going on? What's this? And so, you know, it was brought to my attention, and that's the way it was.
What was the first thing you felt when you saw that? Because you're talking about the video of when he was being dragged by the police or something like that to the
when he's put in the paddy wagon.
Put in the paddy wagon?
Correct. Before he was put in the paddy wagon. Yeah, it was when he was on the ground, and then he ultimately was led to
What was the first thing you felt when you saw that?
I was appalled. And I wanted to really get to the bottom of it. You know, I didn't know what happened beforehand. I didn't want to judge too quickly because that's what often happens is you see an image and then you're like, oh, okay, this is what's going on. I really wanted to get to the bottom of it. So it was appalling. However, I really didn't want to judge and I didn't know what was happening. So I wanted to make sure that we responded right away and we needed to get to the bottom of it.
Jada talks about like how Freddie Gray is not that much different. Like Jada, she when we were talking about just the Freddie Gray situation, she just becomes like this strong advocate and just like empathizer because she talks about like how Freddie Gray is not that much different than a lot of our clients in our
just
program.
Over the weeks that when all of the unrest was happening in the city, when we got to know more about Freddie Gray, I realized that he's like a lot of the other clients that we have in West Baltimore. He had lead paint poisoning. He'd had a previous record before his parents were substance users. And we see that a lot with some of the clients that we service. I mean, it's really, it just kind of, it broke my heart. I felt like Freddie Gray was kind of the client that we hadn't had an opportunity to provide an intervention for, the client that we hadn't had an opportunity to help. And I also saw him, you know, people will judge, particularly African-American men, when they see them on TV. But when you know these people and you go into the communities, you realize the needs of the community and the needs of the family. And so I know Freddie Gray, for me, it struck a chord. And it made me realize what we need to do even more in our community to help the Freddie Grays to prevent stuff like this from happening again. So
So without going too far into all of your programming, but you do have prevention programming that a lot of people might not know about, correct?
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that we focus on in Freddie Gray, and you're absolutely right, Jada, Freddie Gray can be your cousin, your nephew, my cousin, my brother. And that was one of the things that was extremely chilling, right? When we think about what happened, not just to Freddie Gray, but a lot of young black men across this country. You know, and I'm 4 months into my term, my first term, you know, and I had to make a decision that I would not take back for a moment. When you have a young 25-year-old man who makes, unfortunately, eye contact with police, who is, you know, unreasonably and unconstitutionally arrested, placed head first, feet shackled, and handcuffed, essentially defenseless in a metal wagon. And then when his pleas for medical attention were ignored, I followed the facts with the law. And I wouldn't do anything differently. I charged those that I deemed or felt we deemed were responsible for his death. So I look at that, and, you know, oftentimes people really focus on the fact that we weren't able to secure convictions. And the one thing that I do take away from Freddie Gray is that he left a legacy. And I feel proud to be a part of that legacy. When we think about the reforms that have been put in place as a result of the death of Freddie Gray, you know, that accountability had not been had across this country, where you're applying justice fairly and equally to everybody, regardless of one's sex, religion, or occupation. You know, that was done. A week after I charged those officers, the Department of Justice came in, exposed the discriminatory policing practices of one of the largest police agencies in the country. That exposure ultimately led to reform. We now have a federally enforceable consent decree that, even despite the federal administration that tried to forestall it, is still on record, right? And because of that reform, we now have a spotlight that has been shown on the entrenched police corruption in Baltimore City. And when we think about it, although those officers weren't held individually and criminally responsible, every single police officer is being held accountable for the actions of a few. Think about the fact that now it is a requirement, it's mandatory for police officers to seatbelt prisoners. It is now a requirement, and it's mandatory when prisoners ask for medical attention that they receive it. It's now, we have full implementation of body-worn cameras on all officers, so you never have to ask why someone's being questioned or detained or stopped and ultimately arrested. You don't have to rely on circumstantial evidence when it comes to what takes place inside of these vehicles. There's cameras in every single police van that has been equipped. Right. And so when you think about and the de-escalation the policies of the police department, the use of force, it's a requirement that they have these de-escalations policies and that they accentuate, you know, the sanctity of life. These are all reforms that have come into place as a result of the tragic death of Freddie Gray.
So when people look at it from a conviction aspect, like, oh, it might have been a loss, if you look at it from a wins loss, from a conviction and non-conviction thing, I guess. But there were a significant amount of milestones and victories reforms. That were taken, reforms that have taken place because of that. My question is, I have a question for you, because prior to the conviction, I mean, prior to the charges being brought, that's when the riot took place and we had all of this other stuff happening. Now, a lot of people would probably say, yeah, she knew she wasn't going to convict them. She just did it because they wanted to, they put the pressure on her so that, to do it so that people could stop going crazy and rioting. What do you say when people ask? So my question is direct, is did you feel threatened or persuaded to like bring charges to address the public outcry?
Absolutely not. I mean, at the end of the day, I have been charged to do my job. And this is the reason why I became a prosecutor. Let me just be clear. The mission of a prosecutor is to seek justice over convictions. As a prosecutor, you don't guarantee convictions. You guarantee the process, right? And you ensure that justice is being applied to everybody fairly and equally. So I followed the facts with the law. And in that case, we had more sort of information because five of the officers, you know, provided admissions, right? Than I do in a lot of other cases that we charge. So no, I didn't succumb to any sort of societal pressure. You know, the uprising was taking place in my community, but at the end of the day, I'm tasked with doing my job. And I can say that that's what I did.
How is that being an elected official? So you're an elected official on one hand, but it's an elected official and it's for Baltimore City. And we know that there's systematic racism and we know that there's been systematic racism in the police department. So you have these people that you represent, but they're the same people who are feeling oppressed by the police department with whom you have to work to get convictions.
So at the end of the day, what I can say is that, you know, it's very clear. I'm not accountable to anybody but those that have elected me. Mm. And my job is to do the right thing. That's your only charge as a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. I went into this to reform the criminal justice system. I can say that we successfully did that in 18 months, right? That's the only charge of a prosecutor. I'm recruiting young mission-oriented prosecutors that understand that. That awesome amount of discretion as a prosecutor, you're the one who decides who's going to be charged, what they're going to be charged with, what sentence recommendations they're going to make. And not only affects defendants, those that are accused of crimes, but you can see all across this country how that discretion has collateral consequences on our community. You are charged with doing the right thing, and even at the expense of anything else.
So... I totally understand that, and you said you just follow the facts and where the charges yep. brought you, and your goal isn't to convict. Your goal is to make sure that the justice process takes place, right?
Correct, and the fact finder are the ones that will ultimately convict, a judge or a jury.
Mm. Gotcha. So where do you see the breakdown, if we want to call it a breakdown, from charges being brought to conviction? Because there are people that are like, Maryland's the savior. they unjustly put all these, this not saying that you're not worthy of praise or anything, but sometimes we put more, faith, not faith, but expectation on somebody than what they could actually do. So when people that were like, I love Maryland, then was like, oh, she didn't convict them. I'm really not for her right now anymore. Mm-hmm. But that's some of that is not your fault. I do understand. But what... where do you see some of the breakdowns in the, from charges to conviction?
So component? I think it's really important for us to understand the way the criminal justice system works, right? And I think that we are now becoming more aware of how the process works. And I think that that's extremely important. Something that we've tried to do is to educate the public. When I dropped those charges, you know, I was very clear as to why I was dropping those charges. Mm-hmm. I can try this case 100 times, mm-hmm. and without systemic criminal justice reforms, we would end up in the same result. One of the things that I pointed out was the fact that, you know, police officers investigating themselves is a problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you look across the country at other major municipalities, that San Francisco, you know, in New York, you have independent investigatory agencies mm-hmm. that are doing the investigation at the earliest stages. So some of the problems that we ran into, you know, when you have individuals who are their colleagues, right? Mm-hmm. You're interrogating your colleague. You're not going to ask the most pertinent question. That's your friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the person that you've gone through the academy with.
Yeah.
So you kind of want them. You're looking at this from a biased sort of perspective, and mm-hmm. it's not just exclusive to police officers. This is with any and every profession, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that when I dropped the charges in Freddie Gray, I came out with a host of proposals, police accountability reform proposals. We need independent investigatory agencies that are looking into police-involved deaths and shootings when it comes to these sorts of investigations. Mm-hmm. And just recently, we had Detective Souter. And now we are talking about independent investigatory agencies coming in.
Yeah.
But I proposed that months ago. Mm-hmm. When we talk about, you know, having civilian participation on trial boards, I said, without that civilian participation, guess what's going to end up happening? Nothing. Mm-hmm. What ended up happening with all six of those officers when they sat in front of those administrative trial boards? There was no civilian participation. They didn't get one single infraction. They weren't mm-hmm. found guilty of one single infraction. That is a problem. When we talk about so many of the reforms that need to be put into place, you know, my investigators in the Freddie Gray case, they didn't have any police powers. Mm-hmm. That's crazy when you consider the fact that when other municipalities, the investigators within the state's attorney's office has the power to serve a search and seizure warrant, you know, has the power of arrest. We had to rely on the sheriff's department in order to do that because the police department, we are giving them, we asked and we got a search and seizure warrant signed. We gave it to them to execute for the personal cell phones among the officers, and they held on to it and didn't return the search warrant without ever executing it.
We
had officers within the department, lead detectives within that case, who were working against us the entire time. They were creating notes that contradicted the medical examiner's report. They turned those notes over to defense counsel months before, then turned it over to us in the middle of trial, and then we were sanctioned for not turning it over when they already had it. So these were some of the issues that we were up against, and we've seen a lot of the same issues that I talked about when I dropped those charges in the GTTF trials, right? The FBI was reluctant to just rely on the police department, Baltimore Police Department. They were fearful that they weren't going to do what needed to be done in the investigation phases. We brought out the fact that some of the highest commands within the department were coaching folks on the police officers on the scene of fatalities. So a lot of what I talked about, we are now seeing. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's really important for us not to focus so much on whether or not we receive convictions and understand the legacy of what Freddie Gray meant to this city. And we look at this, right, and all of the reforms that have been put into place, and we are going to look back in retrospect and say that this was a turning point for changing the culture of an entire, the eighth largest police department in the country.
You know, I can honestly say for me, it was one of those things where people will just, we all know, the citizens know, but this shined a light on it to make us feel like, okay, we're not crazy. So it's not just in our heads. This is really going on. This is really happening.
Right. So you had people that were excited for you, right? And then you also had other people like the Fraternal Order Police who weren't excited about what was happening and really tried to press charge. I mean, not press charge, but sue you and your department or whatever.
No, sue me personally.
Try to sue you personally.
It's still pending.
So this is basically my question. How are you impacted personally by this case? I know that some of the things that you said, you've shown how the whole process is reforming and has great impacts of what you've done. But personally, from a personal perspective, I'm pretty sure this wasn't an easy thing as well. It's been an easy process.
It's definitely not an easy sort of process. You know, I've looked to my family and my faith. You know, that's what the one thing that keeps me grounded, right? But I also understand, and I think that this has to do with when I was a six-year-old, right? Like, this is so much greater than me individually. The backlash that I received, you know, hate mail and death threats for months. You know, I got a description of how my husband would walk out the house and be killed on our front steps and no police would respond.
Oh, wow.
But, like, I get that it's so much greater than me individually. It's about what I represent. And I go back to that 95% of prosecutors in this country being white, 79% being white men, and me being a woman of color representing 1%, challenging the status quo.
And the youngest.
And you got ageism, sexism, racism, but it's greater than you. And so you learn very quickly, and I had to learn very quickly not to internalize that. Like, it's not about Marilyn Mosby. It's about what Marilyn Mosby represents. And just as much hate that I got in challenging the status quo from, you know, police unions across the nation, essentially, I got a lot of love, too. I have so much love within the community, little girls who, you know, who understand and recognize that they can do and be anything that they want to be because they see me in this role. So it's I don't internalize it.
So like you're saying, this, what you have done has had a profound impact on the country, right? It's obviously shed light on what's already happening, what's been happening that often doesn't get talked about. We saw others being killed in other cities and and people, nothing happening, no charges being brought. So what you have done has changed the criminal prosecution landscape of our country. I see more people at least being, charges being filed and stuff like that. And this is something that you've done first, you know, and is leading to more people doing that. And I want to say thank you for that. But this also may sound crazy, given the reform and everything that has happened and how far, you know, things are advancing now. But I want to ask you, what would you have done differently?
I think I've been very clear. I wouldn't do anything differently. I wouldn't do anything differently. I'm proud to be a part of the legacy, you know, that Freddie Gray has left.
I'm glad you didn't say I wouldn't have walked down the steps, because that was one of my favorite moments. When you walked down the steps to the microphone, it was like Olivia Pope-ish and everything. I was like, I was about to throw up my Wakanda X and everything. If Wakanda would have been out for that, I would have threw up my X and everything.
Yes.
But no, I'm just trying to soften it. But no, literally, that was one of my favorite. But, you know, I'm just curious, like, if you're thinking back, like, hey, you know what? I might have, whatever, you know, I have no idea, but I'm just curious, like, being, because we always look, hey, here's everything I've done great. But man, if I would have did this one thing differently, might have could have had more of an impact or whatever. And it might not be, hey, I wouldn't have brought charges. It might have just been something along the process.
So again, I think it was definitely a learning experience, and we can look back now and see what that moment, you know, what that decision meant to this city. And so, you know, in retrospect, I look back, and again, I wouldn't do anything differently.
It seems to me, hearing you talk about it, it seems that what you encountered is what a lot of people encounter when they come up against institutions.
Yeah.
The field is rigged. It's rigged.
It is.
With knowing all of this, where do we go from here? What is the community, the impact that it's had on the community? Where do we go from here? What's your thoughts?
So I think where we go from here is that, again, we're in the midst of change, and change feels uncomfortable when you're in the midst of it. Believe me, I know. But we're going to look back, and, you know, Baltimore has a unique opportunity to be a model for the rest of the country. So when it comes to criminal justice reform, we need to push back on a federal administration that's touting regression is making America great again on the backs of black and brown people. You know, and that's going to come from these local elections, these, you know, local state positions. We got to pay attention. We got to stay woke. We don't have the ability of, you know, just being willy-nilly, not paying attention. We got to pay attention, you know, when it comes to politics and, you know, and ensuring that we're investing in our young people.
So we have a new police commissioner. What is your relationship now with the police department and the commissioner?
So I have a great relationship with the police department, and I know that there's a misconception that there's some sort of chasm. And at first, yeah, it's kind of like, everybody is within the police department is pretty much shell-shocked that you're doing something that's not typically done. But we've been able to work through that. And I think one of the things that's indicative of that relationship, I've sat down with the police commissioner, Daryl D'Souza. We have a great sort of rapport. I had a great rapport even with Kevin Davis. Is that what's indicative of that relationship? Because you do have a codependence. We prosecute between 45,000 and 50,000 cases a year in Baltimore City. You rely upon the police department to get these bad guys off the street. We still have a 93% felony conviction rate. You know, I think that that is extremely high. I think that that's, again, indicative of the sort of relationship that we currently have with the police department.
Cool. So, like, I was...
And we've convicted every single public enemy number one that's been designated by the Baltimore Police Department.
You were just stating before we started that something happened yesterday, correct?
Yeah. We actually just took down an alleged drug organization. They've been indicted. So the defendants are presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty. But we took down, we worked and collaborated with Anne Arundel County, State Police, the DEA, and the Baltimore Police Department. We had a long-term investigation, which included wires, and we took down at least five individuals that were distributing and even trafficking heroin and fentanyl. And right now, with this opioid crisis that we're dealing with in not just Baltimore City, but our entire state, and that lethal sort of fentanyl, just small doses of it can be extremely detrimental.
I actually watched a show. What was that on? Is it on Netflix or is it on somewhere? And it's like, I can't remember the name of it, but they had an episode on Baltimore. And they were talking about the fentanyl that's happening.
Oh, it's bad.
And you know what's so funny? It was actually some people, some things happening out of Anne Arundel County because they would have just a whole bunch of deaths because of that fentanyl stuff. I can't remember the name of the show, but I was watching that as well.
Well, that's what we did. We took down some of the alleged drug organizations that were distributing and trafficking a heroin fentanyl mix.
Yeah.
So you seem to have, I mean, well, not seem, you have a, like you said before, it's a codependent relationship that you have with the police department. How do you work with people who may be angry because of the Freddie Gray or who may not necessarily be supportive of you anymore?
So, I mean, you just learn how to deal with it. You know, at the end of the day, I'm doing my job. And I think that, you know, when you, I think that we're at a point where people understand that, right? Okay. Like, it's not personal. And I never take even animosity toward me personal. You know, I'll still smile and still continue to be cordial and still to do my job because that's what we're here to do. It's not personal.
I wonder, what are your thoughts on systemic racism?
So I think that one of the issues, and I know Chris is going to wait until we get to this section. But
go ahead. All right. This is your professional part right here. So this is where programming and everything
one
is.
One of the things that is extremely important, I think, you know, just being in this role as a prosecutor is that the reason why I wanted to be a prosecutor is because of the disproportionate impact that it has, the criminal justice system has on communities of color. Mm-hmm. And when we look, for far too long, we've had this tough on crime approach that has impacted Black families, and we've incarcerated and led to mass incarceration for nonviolent offenders. Well, my approach is a little different. I'm going to go tough on individuals that deserve to be tough. And that's why, you know, I'll tout the 93% felony conviction rate. I'll tout the fact that we got convicted every single public enemy number one that's been designated by the Baltimore Police Department. Of those 16 individuals, only 4 cases are still pending. Of the 12 individuals, they have a cumulative sentence of 6 life sentences plus 598 years. We will go hard on individuals with no code of ethics, targeting women, targeting seniors, targeting children. Mm-hmm. But for far too long, this role has not been one in which we've taken a holistic approach to prosecution. We have to address the systemic issues as to why crimes take place. Mm-hmm. So you look at our city. It's located in one of the richest states in the entire country. But we can no longer continue to ignore the fact that 24% of Baltimore's population lives in poverty. And you guys see this every single day.
Every day.
35% of our babies live below poverty. Mm-hmm. You cannot ignore the blight in our community, right? 18,000 vacant houses, 16,000 vacant lots. You can't ignore the unemployment rate. And I say this because we get these statistics on young African-American men being slaughtered out in our streets every day. Somebody's being shot. Somebody's being killed. They're referred to as a number. But we don't ever focus on the fact that between the ages of 18 and 24, young African-American men, their unemployment rate is more than twice as high than that of whites. We don't focus on the median household income, which is more than twice as low than that of whites. We don't focus on the fact that, you know, the suspension rates among African-American children are so much higher than that of whites, right? And we also don't focus on the fact that we've put so much investment in public safety and not as much investment in our young people. Last year, I charged more juveniles with attempted murder, twice as many juveniles with attempted murder and murder than almost the past 2 years combined. That is completely unacceptable. So what I've done is to take a different approach. We're taking a holistic approach.
What'd you do?
We had, thank you, Chris, for asking. We started a crime control and prevention division where we ensure that we're getting the young people before they get to the criminal justice system. You know, we have a program that we just recently launched called Project 17. We're focused on the 21217 area code, where that's where the uprising took place.
That's my favorite. That's my favorite zip code to work in.
That's my, I live it. In that
Really?
Yes, I love it.
I'm tell all your Greenmount people that you said that. Because you know Jada from Greenmount.
Which is why I worked in West Baltimore. I'm serious. I loved. Go
ahead. 21217 is my area code. That's where we live.
Yeah, I like that area
code. And we,
that's the Reservoir Hill area and everything.
Yes, Reservoir. And it's Sandtown Winchester. So it's that whole area.
So believe it or not, one of my first stores when I had the See No Clothing line was on North Avenue. Fulton and Riggs.
Okay.
Yeah, right there was a Bell's Bond place, and then we had it as a... As a See No Clothing store. And the police department was right there on Riggs. So we were right over there. And people don't notice, I used to actually have a little apartment in the back of the store that I actually stayed in. I had, you know.
Small business owner.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You got to do what you got to do, right?
Well, that program that we introduced is, it actually taps into small business owners. We went into Frederick Douglass Renaissance Academy, and we're focusing on chronically truant young people, 11th and 12th graders, so 11th and 12th graders that aren't going to school more than 50% of the time. We want to ensure that we're going to get to them. And it's so crazy because the first time that we went into the schools to try to figure out from their perspective, what do you think you can do to reduce violence? And what we got back from them, I had a young man who said to me, I hear you, Miss Mosby, when you talk about don't think about instant gratification. He said, but I'm raising 4 little girls, my sisters. My mother's dead. My father's incarcerated. And if I have to get out here and sell drugs in order to put a roof over their head and food in their mouths, I'm going to do what I have to do. We were thankfully able to connect him to a job, getting a job, and he's back in school. He graduated. But how many young men are out there like that?
Tons.
And so that's what the program does. We connect those young people, chronically truant young people, with small businesses, and they go through life skills training, job skills training, entrepreneurship skills, and they provide an economic opportunity, employment, and also that mentorship.
That's awesome. That is amazing.
That's one program.
Give me some more. I know you're right. Yeah, first of all, I wish that I knew all of my personal stats like Marilyn knows hers and just all the stats, because I would be walking through the office. Yesterday I did such and such a day before I did such and such at this percent. I'm operating at a 90% no-show ratio because of my transportation efficiency efforts.
Don't worry, I'll tell everybody your stats.
I'm going to start doing my – wait till I get the front desk and transportation working together. I'll be like, where did we start at as a no-show rate? Yes, I've improved that to a 99% no-show rate. I'm gonna boast my stats.
You got to promote what you're doing.
Hey,
you
know? I'm not gonna let her live this one down. Be like, Jada, you're only operating at 43% efficiency, and currently I am.
I'm sorry, Jade. I'm sorry.
Poor me. But people don't know unless you tell them.
No,
you gotta tell
them. They're not gonna know. Mm-hmm. You know, and the media, unfortunately, mm-hmm. mainstream media wants to focus on negativity because that's what
very
sells.
True.
So one of the things that got me excited about all the work that you do, not just from a prosecution standpoint, but it's all the additional programming that you're doing. And most people don't know about this. They think that you just bring forth charges and like you're putting good people behind bars and all this other stuff, right? If they're looking at it from their family perspective, right. Like that was my cousin, that was this. But talk about some of the other programming that you do.
So in addition to the Project 17, which we just launched about 2 weeks ago, we have several other youth programs. One of our pop-up events, you know, we looked at the crime trends on Friday nights between 6 and 9 and saw an increase in youth violence. So for 12 weeks in the summertime, we partnered with over 31 public-private partnerships. We touched more than 2,437 young people. And essentially, we opened up recreational opportunities for these young folks every Friday night between those hours in which there was an increase in violence. And so they did laser tag and bowling and skate night. And it was so successful that we started doing that in the winter, and we do it once a month.
We just recently did
the ice skating.
I'm going to find out you have a – I didn't mean to cut you off. Let me find out you have a social work paradigm in which you work in. You did an evaluation. You identified what the issue was. You developed a treatment plan.
Absolutely.
And you executed.
We got a social work in my office.
This is social work month. We got to shout her out before this thing is over.
Too.
It's social work month. And we wanted to bring you on to talk about a lot of the programming that you're doing because it's affecting our communities and it's similar to a lot of work that we're doing
absolutely.
Here. I know that you have the bereavement and grief counseling thing as well, right?
Yeah. In my office, we have the only bereavement center in the entire state of Maryland. Mm. So it offers lifetime grief counseling.
So not just in this zip code, but in the entire state of Maryland.
In the entire state of Maryland.
Wow. And you did that.
It was already in existence. That was already in existence for the state's attorney's office. But what we've done is we've increased the grant funding by more than 27%. And we've doubled the size of the victim witness unit. Mm. Understanding and recognizing that, you know, we can't do our jobs without the community. Mm. And victims and witnesses are integral in getting these convictions. But when you put your life in jeopardy, we want to ensure that we're going to protect you. I'm excited because on Monday, and I didn't even tell you about this, but on Monday we're going to be revealing our renovation. We work with a black architectural firm called Design Angels.
Oh, wow.
And we did a whole bunch of research around trauma. Wow. And we were able to bring them to the fold, and we got a $2.4 million federal grant to better protect victims and witnesses, the largest grant we've ever received in the state's attorney's office. But essentially we had funds that have renovated the space.
Wow.
And it's based upon research, and we have computer stations. We have like a kid's corner.
I've got to see
it. It's like HGTV up in there.
I need to go.
And it is so cool because when you look at the dark, dank sort of mm-hmm. courthouse that they were in, where you're waiting hours on end for mm-hmm. for your case to be called, yep. you know, I'm excited that we're able to really just change that space mm-hmm. altogether. And it's we're going to be actually doing that and doing a ribbon cutting on Tuesday.
Let us know. We'll can stop by.
We would love to come.
That's kind of like the approach that we took with mm-hmm. like our center as well, because this used to be Child Protective Services. Mm-hmm. And it was like green paint on the wall and some stuff like this. it was a place where people used to come and have traumatic experiences about mm-hmm. being here.
Right.
And it was, so we came in, we brightened the paint color. We brought bright and white furniture in mm-hmm. to make it a real high-end but then also refreshing place so that, you know, families who have gone through things can come here for as a place of healing and outlet and all absolutely. That other stuff.
Well, I went in there, I was like, I don't want to leave. We got a green wall. I mean, it's phenomenal. And awesome. These architects did, I mean, they did a phenomenal job. I would love to introduce you guys.
Oh, we will be there Tuesday?
Yeah, Tuesday.
I'm going to put that on my task organizer now. professionally, is there any other things you want to give us before we move on?
So, I mean, the other thing that I think is really important to highlight is it's not just about prosecution of criminals or individuals that are accused of a crime. It's also about your understanding. Remember, the mission of a prosecutor is justice mm-hmm. over convictions. And so when those that are wrongly accused are convicted and wrongly incarcerated, it's also your responsibility as the state, as the prosecutor, to exonerate them. Mm. And under my administration, again, I have the only conviction integrity unit in the entire state of Maryland where we do actual claims of innocence. We reinvestigate actual claims of innocence. And we've had two exonerations. One young man who was wrongly accused and incarcerated for more than 17 years of murder. And thanks to DNA evidence, he was exonerated. But unfortunately, only after 3 months of being exonerated, he died wow. from succumbing and trying to assimilate back into society.
Yeah.
You know, and the second young man, it was thanks to witness testimony that came forward and we did a reinvestigation and the community said, that's not the man who did it. And so we were able to exonerate him of murder after 14 years being incarcerated or wrongly accused.
I love that justice over conviction rates. I love that.
Nice. So let's get into a little personal. Is that okay?
Sure.
We ain't gonna get too personal, just a little sure. personal, okay? So Jada, this is one of Jada's questions because she's a mom and she's going through all of this stuff. Go ahead.
How do you manage it all? I know I'm busy and I'm tired and I got a boatload of concealer under my eyes right now. How in the world do you manage it all? Campaigning, on the road, nicks away, like what in the world?
So I think that first and foremost, I have a great sort of support network. You know, Nick is also a public servant, so he's away and mm-hmm. he's there, but he's a great sort of balance for me. And our girls, the way that we brought them up is if I can't bring them to a community association meeting, he's going to bring them to, you know, the floor
yeah.
on the delegate, in the House of Delegates side. Or in city council. Mm-hmm. So my girls are very privy to what's happening in the politics. Like they can tell you every councilmatic district and who represents that councilmatic district.
Awesome.
But I think it's that aspect of it. And it's understanding and recognizing that, you know, we can't do it all. You mm-hmm. can't feel guilty about it,
yeah.
right? Like if you need help, and we have a great support system from my sister-in-law and my nieces who, you know, help us and will pick the girls up from school mm-hmm. and ensure that, you know, if I have a late night and Nick is in Annapolis, that my girls are protected and they're in the bed by the time I get home. It's understanding and recognizing that you can't do it all, but that you sometimes need help.
Yes.
And there is no sort of real balancing act, mm-hmm. right? Like, in the hard job at the end of the day, everything else is easy. When you get home, you're tired. You've mm-hmm. been battling the press. You've been battling, you know, police. You've been battling your staff. And you still get home and you got this little 7-year-old looking at you like, what's up, mommy? Pointing at a watch like it's story time.
Right.
Like, and you just got to get into mommy mode.
So speaking of mommy mode, right? Well, I guess I can't speak too much on mommy mode, right? But I look at the way I parent. Like, I know I got an 8-year-old son, and I'm trying to find out what works for him because the way my parents raised me and whatever they did doesn't work for him. You know?
It's a different age.
It's a yeah. different age. It's mm-hmm. technology. How do you keep up? Are you like how your mom was? Are you a parent like how you were parented, or are you staying relevant with the times and like an alternative or taking an alternative approach to these things?
I try to stay relevant with the times, but I mean, they are technologically advanced nowadays.
Kids are so
it's
savvy.
Crazy. I had my phone, and for months, I could not, every time I put my thumbprint on it, it wouldn't open. So I'm like, okay, well, something's wrong with this phone. I'm not going to pay attention. And one day, my little 9-year-old picks up my phone and just puts her thumbprint on my phone, and it immediately opened. I said, what did you change my thumbprint? She's like, oh yeah, mommy, I did that months ago. Then I look in the little description, it says mommy no, Nylon yes. So yes. I try to keep up with these little young folks, but they are technologically inclined.
They are.
And Santa gave them, you know, made the mistake of getting them iPads for Christmas, but I gave them all of my family members' numbers. So
they FaceTiming everybody. Oh man, my son will FaceTime you in a heartbeat. Yes.
With nothing to talk about.
Nothing to talk about.
What you doing? But I'm like, don't just do mommy, baby. Do all of the family members. Everybody like, why did you? Hey.
So how do you parent, like being in the spotlight with all of that stuff and keeping the kids grounded, but then protected from like outside scrutiny and all that other stuff?
So my kids are pretty savvy, especially technologically, right? Like, I forgot what she said to me today, but she asked a question, and I didn't know the answer, and she knew it. And I said, how do you know that? She said, oh, I just Googled it.
That's Siri.
And she's seven. Alexa. Right? Uh-huh. But I don't think there's any sort of right way to, you know, just do it.
I think we're all winging it.
You didn't get the parenting book, like, where it tells you everything that goes up the right way?
If somebody had the formula, like, I think they would be rich. I don't think there's a right
way. I'm going
to
come up with that, and that's going to be one of my stats.
Don't do that.
I've improved parenting by 73%.
In 20 years from now, they would disprove all of it. I read a book a long time ago called The Good Enough Mother. It's changed my life.
I'm with you on that, Jay.
So I'm going to take this back to a relationship goals type of podcast. So we talked about you being a mom. We talked about some things that we didn't really get into, what you do for self-care, respite, because we know that's important as well. We do yoga here. Mm-hmm. We got all these other things going on. But I'm going to take it to the Relationship Goal podcast, give a little subliminal shout-out to my wife, Janine, and her podcast.
Oh, that was a good one. Good,
but,
good job.
But what do you guys, with all these chaotic schedules, political, how do you guys find time for yourself and find other things to talk about other than just politics? That's you and Nick, by the way.
So I think it's really important that you do find that time. We've been together for 20 years. We've been married for 13 years. And like just last weekend, it was his birthday, right?
Oh, really?
Like, yeah. So you just gotta.
You
want to
tell how old
moments.
He is? You want to put him out there?
He's 39. I told him you're getting almost 40, shorty. But you just have to work around it, right? And you have to be understanding and recognize that, you know, I got to get through these next 3 months until this re-election. Right. And so we kind of made some compromises. You know, I took him to a hotel for the weekend.
All right.
But in between the hotel, like, we had to work, like, on Saturday, right? Like, his birthday is Saturday. Yeah. So the first part of that morning, I'm working, and then the rest of the night is all yours.
Okay.
And then the
all
next
right.
morning, guess what? We working. But so it's understanding and giving that give and take. But it's also, it's the same way with our little girls, right? Mm-hmm. Because they make the most sort of sacrifice having two public servants as parents. And what we do is we try to make the most of the time that we do have together. So for Christmas, understanding that I was going to be on the campaign trail, that, you know, it was going to be picking up because I'm still working and all of the things that we have going on. You know, we took them to Disney World for Christmas.
Oh, awesome.
Like, yeah. And that's not something
Jada
that you do every
back.
Year, right?
Jada just got back.
I'm tired.
You're tired, right?
You need a vacation from that vacation.
I need a vacation from that vacation. But yes, so we do that and try to make the most of the time that they have, because the kids will make you feel guilty. Like, my little girl is into soccer, and she will be the first one like, oh, mommy, I know you can't come to this, so. And I'm like, wait a minute.
I'm going to be there.
I'm going to be there. Why you say that? Because you don't come that often. I'm like, wait a minute. I came to this, and this one. I came to five of them. Oh, yeah, you did come to five. But that, you know.
I feel like I'm talking to myself right now.
That's what kids do. And then you just have to understand and recognize that, you know, you can't do it all. And like you said, you're good enough,
good
mom.
Enough.
And they know you make the most of that time and that you love them and you're going to provide for them. And they get it.
Yep.
So for your voters. You have an election day coming up. When is election day?
June 26th. And the week before is early voting.
Early voting. So last year, was it last year, 2 years?
It was 3 years ago.
Wow.
Yes.
I just didn't want to think I was that old.
It feels like it's been 35 and a half years.
So 3 years ago, were you the favorite when you ran?
Oh, no. When I ran, it was 4 years ago.
Okay.
But I won 3 years ago. I ran 4 years ago, won 3 years ago. No, I've been in office for 3 years, won 4 years ago.
Okay.
But in any event, I ran against a powerful white male incumbent who had the ability of raising close to $1 million.
Wow.
Everybody said that I was too young, I was too inexperienced, that I couldn't raise enough money, that me running for this position would not only interrupt but potentially destroy my husband's political career. You know, stay at home, be with your kids is what I was told over and over and over again. But, you know, it was a moment for me to kind of reflect, right? if God is for you, who can be against you, right? And so I looked to my faith and I asked myself, if not me, then who? If not now, then when? And it was because of a great support network and a group of our friends who just believed in our vision that we made it happen. And we ran a grassroots effort and we got the vote out. I beat the incumbent by, and who outraised me 4-1.
She's about to give out some more percentages.
Beat the incumbent by double digit percentage points. And now I'm going to have to do it again.
All right.
So what do voters need to know? What do they need to know? What do they need to do? How can they get involved? How can they make sure that this election day is a success?
Well, I can tell you right now, we just opened up the campaign headquarters. It's 1023 Cathedral Street. It's right across from the Waxer Senior Center, right next to City Cafe. Come down. Get on these phones. Get on the doors.
Are you right next to City Cafe?
Yeah, we.
Oh,
right,
I'll be down there all the time.
You need
to. BLT.
We're not playing. You know, and we understand and recognize that there are a lot of forces that understand and recognize that it's greater than me, and if they can make an example out of me by not being the next state's attorney, that's what they will do. You better believe there's going to be national cameras on the night of the election to see whether or not I've won the election. So I would encourage, you know, I get that it's bigger than me. It would send a message to Aramis Ayala in Orlando. It would send a message to Kim Fox in Chicago and Kim Gardner in St. Louis.
All right.
You know, those are the other black women who are now prosecutors in this country following my election. But please, I just encourage you, you know, there's going to be a lot of negativity, people with no plan. Just the plan is just to attack me. Understand and recognize and consider the source and know that, you know, MarilynMosby.com, you can always donate. Money is
click the donate tab.
It's so important because you have to get up on TV. You got to remind folks to come out here and vote and remind.
That's the biggest
people,
thing they need to do.
Yes, you got to get out here and vote.
Do not take for granted that she's won. That because you love her, everybody else loves her, everybody else is going to get out. Your vote is going to matter. You got to get out here and cast your ballot.
And we see what happens when we stay home. I won't expound further, but we all know what happens when we stay home.
So people can donate by there. Do you have any other upcoming fundraisers? Jada, like, yeah, can you shout out my baby daddy?
Yes. We're going to have a fundraiser. Actually, we didn't start promoting it, but we're going to be doing it on March 31st at Glory Day.
Look at Jada.
Glory
Day, girl. Look at, she's blushing. Jada's
Glory blushing. Glory Day's Grill. We're going to be having a fundraiser on March.
Chris will be like, yeah, you had a fundraiser?
March 31st. It's the final four on Saturday, and we're going to have a special guest. If you guys know ESPN commentator Lisa Salters will be the special guest.
Oh, Lisa.
Yes. Yes, I'm awesome. Excited.
Awesome. See, for me, I will end with my perspective on this. I feel like that this is a moment in time that people, we have to, this is bigger than electing Marilyn Mosby, no offense.
It is.
But it's, as you said, you've echoed this. It's to me, it's about making sure that we support somebody who has done the right thing. Because a lot of times, what we have shown is that when the police, we can't count on them all the time to do the right thing. And this is not me to disparage the police or anything, but sometimes you can't count on, facts show that you can't count on them to do the right thing. And then if we have somebody in office that's going to hold people accountable to their actions, we cannot just sit back and watch her get attacked by fraternal order police and all these other places to come against her, to knock her out of the office, because this is about culture. If we show that, hey, somebody who's finally stood up and did the right thing, who did what was best, who let the facts lead them in that direction and did what was best and did the right thing, if they stand up against the institution, they'll be put out. And now it'll make other people go back into hiding and be scared to stand up. So for me, one, as a father that has a daughter, one. But more than that, it's me, somebody that believes in your plan and your agenda, too. But then three, it's about the moment. It's about the culture to stand up to show, hey, we will not allow this person to be attacked. And we will not just sit by idly while this happens and let you disparage them and just punish them for doing what we know is right. So for me, that's my mission. And that's why I wanted to, not why I wanted to have you on a podcast. I wanted to have you on a podcast because I want to just discuss the community stuff and get your perspective. But that's why you have my vote.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Thank you. But before you leave, we're gonna do a rapid fire real quick, right? We got to know you a little bit. They got to know you professionally, personally. They got some Freddie Gray. Oh, she flipped her hair. She like, I'm ready for this. So we're gonna do a little rapid fire, right? Are you ready? These are gonna be some hard questions here, all right?
All right.
And I need you to be ready, okay?
All right.
All right. So your favorite song to chill when you want to chill, and then your favorite song when you want to get pumped.
When I want to get pumped, it's going to be Beyonce, and it's going to be...
what song, though?
It's... I played this when I passed the bar. Oh,
Crazy in Love.
Crazy in Love. Crazy in Love. Okay. I will go crazy in a heartbeat over Crazy in Love.
You start doing a walk and you
no,
do a drop and come back
up. It's a mental thing.
Like, because some people be in the mirror and they get it. If Jada's song comes on, she loves it. Meek Mill. And you see, like, her eyes turn this color, and then she just starts going, hold on, wait a minute. Y'all thought I was finished?
Yes. No, but that's for my, me, that's it's my Beyonce, song. Crazy in Love. And I pulled up to the place where we were taking a bar, and oh, my goodness, all these people were looking at me. I was blasting it. I was ready. I was like, don't look at me.
And what about your song, your chill song? When you want to relax
song,
and take it easy.
Right now, I think my chill song would probably be Her. And Best Part.
Oh,
I love that song. Yeah. I love that song.
Favorite actor or actress?
Favorite actor, which comes to mind? I love Will Smith, and I love Jada.
He's killing
Pinkett
Instagram
Smith.
Right now, too.
He is. He's so, he has some things that you think about.
I know.
Like,
I didn't even say that one.
He said about self-discipline.
Oh, yeah. My gosh, yes.
Self-discipline.
Yes.
And he was like, when you forego the immediate pleasure for your long-term self-respect.
That's crazy. That struggle
that's
been
in my
too.
Head. That's been in my head for like 2 weeks.
It made me not eat bread yesterday at Texas Roadhouse.
Yes.
You didn't eat bread at Texas Roadhouse because of Will Smith.
Yes.
No,
it was
self-discipline.
I'll send it to you.
It's self-love.
I saw it. Favorite book.
Favorite book, I would have to say, what comes to mind is The New Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander.
Mm, yeah, nice. That's good.
Favorite restaurant? You don't have to be biased because Jada's right here.
No, I'm going
to
say my favorite restaurant is Thames Street Oyster House.
Oh,
my goodness. They have this killer lobster roll, and I'm from New England, and it's hard to compete, but that is the best. Chris, we got to take you and Janine there.
Yeah, please,
you
please.
You too, Jada. It's bomb.
Favorite hobby?
Favorite hobby? I don't have a hobby. What do I like to do? I like playing spades.
You like playing spades?
I do. I love playing spades.
So we're having game night tomorrow here at the office, right? And we've been talking to spades crap and everything. However, I have
this
to go. It's my son's birthday, so I can't be here. So the next one is March 30th. I need a space partner. Do you think you can
See,
make
I
yourself available?
I take it
available?
Really serious, though.
I throw
like,
cards
get,
at people.
I get
like,
angry.
I smack cards
this
down.
This is why
I
can't
with
spades. It's too much.
It's very intense.
Can you have your scheduler? Check your scheduler. Let me know
I
if you're available to be my
I'll
space
check.
Partner.
And I like traveling, so.
Okay.
I can play Uno.
What was it?
Pile up,
Jada?
Yes, pile up. It's
okay,
only one way to play.
All right. Can I put my drawer 4 on top of your drawer, too?
Absolutely.
Okay,
that's
cool.
A drawer 6.
What was it that you wanted to be when you were 5 years old?
When I was 5 years old, I wanted to be a lawyer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Awesome. So now I'm going to give you some one or the other questions, and we're going to run through these really quickly, okay? Family Matters or Full House?
You said what?
Family Matters or Full House?
Family Matters.
Martin or Fresh Prince?
Martin.
Love Jones or Best Man?
Best Man.
Basketball or football?
Football.
I think I know this next one. Destiny's Child or Escape?
Destiny's Child.
Chris or Jada?
Jada. Wait. I thought you were for Jada Pinkett.
No.
But it's Jada.
And I'm your sorry. Favorite podcast is?
Right here. BTSE
podcast. Meeting
That's
you
right.
where you are. This show is a wrap, Jada. How you think?
This was amazing.
I had a good time.
Thank you, guys. I had so much fun.
Thank
Too
you,
much
thank
fun. Now I got to get back to work.
So we're out of here. Thank you, guys.